Salutations, sports nerds. It's time for another edition of War on Hot Takes, presented by Capital News Service. I'm Adam Zalanka, and with me, as always, is Dylan Sin. We hope you're following us on Twitter by now, at War on Hot Takes, and staying tuned to cnsmaryland.org for not only new editions of this podcast, but also some excellent stories on local sports, politics, and more. You can always check out our past episodes of War on Hot Takes on cnsmaryland.org. For instance, make sure to listen to our interview with Kevin Blackstone from last week if you missed it the first time around. Dylan, what's on tap today?
On today's show, we're going to figure out what happened last Friday when LeBron James dropped 57 points on the Wizards. But don't worry, we aren't buying into the hot takes about the state of Washington basketball. We'll check out the local NFL teams as always. Big win for Washington this weekend. And our fellow CNS reporter Daniel Chavkin will return to the program to discuss his story on the Jay Gruden coaching tree. But let us begin with basketball. We haven't talked about the Wizards in a while, but we're going to just talk about them right now. And before we get started with actually talking about the Wizards, we have a new segment that we're going to try to throw out here for you and see what you think. We have found a hot take online, and we are going to show you what it is, and then we are going to try to take it down.
We need to call it something. Can't call it hot takedown, as much as that sounds great. That's what the old 538 podcast used to be called.
That is taken, so we will not say that. But essentially, we are going to throw this hot take out there, and we are going to rebut it because it is a hot take.
So, want me to read it?
What is our hot take for this week?
This comes from a Twitter user. His handle is at Stephen A. Smith. Here is Stephen A. Smith's first take about the Wizards and Cavaliers last Friday night, in which the Cavaliers won 130-122, but LeBron James came to town and dropped 57 on the Wizards, which is the highest point total LeBron has had since returning to Cleveland. Here we go. Stephen A. Smith. At King James is just destroying the at Wash Wizards tonight. 49 points with more than 3 minutes left and counting, completely destroying them. Once again, Beal shows up and at John Wall doesn't. Wall, great guy and fantastic two-way player. But a suspect jumper zaps his confidence. Hashtag truth!
You know it's a hot take when they throw the hashtag truth in there.
We needed to know.
It's a dead giveaway.
Hate to say, we got three more tweets to read. This was before we all got 280. He had a string of short ones. Spectacular, unstoppable performance by at King James. But would he have been this loose if at John Wall was on his game, like at Real Deal Beal 23? 5 question marks.
For those of you who don't know, at Real Deal Beal is the Twitter handle Bradley Beal.
Yeah, I'm reading Twitter handles if you didn't pick that up. For now, at Wash Wizards, just another good team. Need another player, plus at John Wall developing consistent jumper and accepting challenge of becoming that star, and star is in all caps. I believe in at John Wall. I really do. But it's time to take this to the next level. Had he been better tonight, Wiz win. That's the end of the hot take. I think that you got to take this in two parts. There's two key elements to this.
Exactly.
One, that John Wall is not that star because of an unreliable jumper. And two, that the Wizards need another player to be more than just another good team.
Right.
Let's start with the first one, Dylan.
As Stephen A. Smith said, he's not wrong. He hasn't shot well this year. In fact, he's below 42%. I think it's 41.2% is John Wall's shooting percentage this year. But what he failed to say was in that game, it seemed like he realized, against the Cavaliers I'm speaking of here, it seemed like he realized he wasn't shooting well early, and he became a facilitator for much of the rest of the game. He finished with 15 assists. He took only 13 shots, so it wasn't like he was hogging the ball and shooting bad shots because he was trying to get his points. He realized he was having an off night shooting and started facilitating. And I don't think that that's the worst thing in the world. It's actually what a good player does.
Yeah, Wall had 15 assists in this game, and 13 attempts sounds like a lot, but remember how high scoring this game was. That was only 15% of the team's attempts. A lot of other players had 19, 14, 10 attempts, and the ball was significantly passed around. Nobody on the team had close to 15 assists besides Wall. The next highest was Beal, had 4 assists.
One thing that we need to mention here is that Stephen A. said the Wizards need another player to be more than just a good team. But what we found early in the season is that they may have already have that player, and he's just coming into his own this year rather than being acquired from a different team. And that player that I'm talking about is Kelly Oubre. Now, we talked about John Wall not having the hot hand that night against the Cavaliers, but Oubre did. He shot 5 for 7 from beyond the three-point line, and that's indicative of a trend this year, which is that Oubre is wildly improved from beyond the arc. In his career, including the small sample size this season, he shot 32.6% from three-point land. This year, he's shooting 49% from three. That's up there with the elite shooters in the league. And obviously, it's still early, but 10 games into the season is not a tiny sample size anymore. It's starting to become statistically significant. Wow, say that five times fast.
Statistically significant. I'm not going to make it.
Right, exactly. And so clearly he has worked and worked and worked on his shooting in the offseason, and he seems to be that guy that is going to help him spread the floor along with Bradley Beal to help John Wall facilitate his drive and kick game that he's so good at. So it's possible the Wizards already have that player that Stephen A. was talking about on the roster.
And now Markieff Morris is...
That's right. Power forward Markieff Morris is back now. The game against the Cavs was his first game back with the Wizards, coming back from hernia surgery. And so it allowed him to slide right back into the starting lineup and moved Oubre back to the bench. So he'll now be able to be a bench scorer for the Wizards coming off and giving them a spark. The Wizards bench, as we've talked about multiple times in the past, is one of their weaker points. And so Morris coming back gives them extra depth. And Oubre's emergence as a three-point shooter gives them an extra scorer off the bench as well.
Ultimately, I think Stephen A. is also suffering from... I don't want to claim that I know how much Wizards basketball Stephen A. has watched this year, but Small Sample Size Incorporated out here in this booth, we're going to nickname it, maybe put a sign up. Based on what you're seeing on one game, LeBron scoring 57, that does not mean, as other people also implied Friday night, that the Wizards have no chance of stopping LeBron in the playoffs. Who knows what the playoffs are going to look like? People run out of gas. There's all sorts of things
LeBron
that could happen.
LeBron is 33 years old.
He's an old man.
he's got to start slowing down at some point. We don't know when. We don't know how it's going to happen. It's going to happen eventually. Maybe not this season, but we'll see.
That is what I've been saying about Tom Brady for 6 years. As a Jets fan, my pain. Feel it now. Well, listen, the point is, why does John Wall's jumper matter so much when the Wizards couldn't defend LeBron on Friday night?
Exactly.
You can make adjustments and fix this. A lot of it might be coaching adjustments on Scott Brooks's part, but ESPN Stats and Info tweeted on Friday night that LeBron James scored double-digit points against four different individual defenders in this game. He scored 16 points when John Wall was covering him, 11 when Oubre was covering him, 11 when Porter was on him, and 10 against Bradley Beal. So that is insane. I don't know if that's ever happened before.
Basically, whoever the Wizards threw at him, he was scoring over them. And no matter how many jumpers John Wall made that night, LeBron was just not going to let Cleveland lose that game. It was clearly a statement game from them, considering they came in under 500. It was one of those nights where he wanted to make a statement. And he's just that good sometimes. But it's not going to happen every single game. And the Wizards were not, even with LeBron scoring 57, they weren't run off the court. They played with him the entire game.
And need we remind Stephen A. Smith, you want to look at one game, let's look at one other game he seemingly has forgotten. When John Wall drilled the game-winning shot in Game 6 last year of the series against the Boston Celtics to force Game 7. So he's not a star, he's not an all caps, capital S, capital S, T, capital A, capital R star. That was not very many months ago, and he seems to have forgotten. Stephen A., consider yourself taken down. The season is young, and the Wizards actually meet the Los Angeles Lakers Thursday night for the second time this season. They'll try to avenge their loss. There was a 3-point loss to LA earlier this year. Thursday night.
As of this recording, the Wizards are 5-5 for the season, and so they're right in the middle of the pack in the Eastern Conference. And against the Lakers, they'll kind of hope to end a troubling trend that they've had going on, which is that they've beaten teams like the Pistons, the 76ers, the Nuggets that have winning records, and then inexplicably lost games to teams like the 4-7 Suns, and then most recently against the 2-10 Dallas Mavericks. The Wizards are one of two wins the Mavericks have, the worst team in the league.
The Mavs are the worst team in the league, and that's pretty inexplicable. If not for the 57-point thing, we might be actually spending the segment discussing what happened against Dallas,
right,
which is a bad team right now. But in the 10 games that Washington's played to this point, their total combined point differential is plus 18. They're winning more games than they're losing in terms of the close ones. They had some good blowout wins. The Cavs are 5-6.
Right. The essential thing is this team is right where we expected them to be. They've had some close losses. They've had some strange losses to bad teams. But we've seen out of the Wizards what we expected to see at the beginning of the year. Beal has stepped up. Oubre stepped up. John Wall is going to shoot better eventually. This Wizards team is exactly where we thought they'd be.
I like it. We're going to see how they play against the Lakers. We'll get back to you on the Wiz later this season. And the rest of this podcast, though, we're going to have to spend on my favorite sport and Dylan's second?
Second?
NFL football. We're going to talk Ravens. We're going to talk Washington for a pretty long time, the rest of this podcast, when we come back. Welcome back to War on Hot Takes.
with Dylan Sin. This is Adam Zalanka. Come at you. We're going to have our NFL weekly breakdown of the two Maryland-based teams here. Your Baltimore, your Washington. Very mediocre teams in a very mediocre league. Kind of confusing teams. Now, of course, as it always seems to go, one team won and one team lost this weekend. But let's start with the team that lost. Get them out of the way because the Baltimore Ravens are coming up on a bye week after we finish this segment. They will be listening, and then they will say, okay, time for our bye week. The Baltimore Ravens lost to Tennessee, 23-20. Comeback effort fell short for Baltimore on Sunday. Dylan, you saw some of this game. What went wrong?
Well, the biggest thing that went wrong, and it's the biggest thing that's been going wrong the whole season, is that the Ravens' deep passing game is essentially non-existent. Again, Joe Flacco, as we've talked about many times this season, has really struggled with throws down the field. This week, he averaged just over 5 yards per attempt, which is pretty abysmal. His yards per attempt for the season is now down to just 5.3, which is a full yard lower than any other season he's had in his entire career.
That's putrid.
Exactly. So he's really struggling, and part of that is because one of the best weapons that he was supposed to have, Breshad Perriman, the 2015 first-round pick, just hasn't really panned out this year. In the previous 2 weeks before this week's game against the Titans, he had zero targets, and obviously then zero catches and 0 yards. And this week he had his quote-unquote best game of the season, which amounted to a total of 3 catches for 28 yards, which is a season high for both, but obviously not where you want to be when you were a first-round pick and you're an incredible athlete as Perriman is. Now, one play in the second quarter really exemplified the issues that the Ravens have had in the deep passing game. Flacco dropped back. He had a clean pocket, all the time in the world to throw. Perriman actually broke open downfield. He had a step beyond the corner, and Flacco threw the ball probably 40 or 45 yards in the air, and the ball, all it did was float. And so he not only floated the ball, but when the ball got close to Perriman, it got tipped away by a Titans safety. But as it was coming down, Perriman was kind of just running under it, and he didn't really make too much of an effort to make the play either. So you could see in that one play the issues that those two have had connecting this season. Flacco just doesn't have the zip on his throws he's had in the past, and Perriman has had trouble going to get the ball, and that's been something that's really plagued them this year.
To combine that poor vertical attack with a running game that has suddenly fallen to the legs of Alex Collins and really hasn't found its footing and stayed consistent week to week, the Baltimore Ravens offense, again, it's tough to watch. So obviously this is a playoff team, right?
Right, exactly. I mean,
4-5.
They are 4-5. The Ravens certainly seem to think, at least a few members of the team certainly seems to think, that they have a shot at the playoffs.
Exactly. Listen to Eric Weddle, the safety, longtime NFL veteran who's played a lot for the Chargers before coming to the Ravens. Eric Weddle this week told ESPN reporter Jameson Hensley, "Why not us? I don't care what everyone else says. Why can't we go on a 7-game winning streak and get into the playoffs? Who says we can't? Look at our schedule." And that is some talk.
Good for Eric Weddle. He has not given up on this Ravens team yet.
The fact is that a lot of teams in the NFL are 3-5, 4-5, 4-4, 5-3, and the playoff situation, the playoff picture, is far from clear at week 10. This is week 10 we're going into. So let's do what Eric Weddle said and look at that Ravens schedule coming up here after their bye week. They play at the Packers and then hosting the Texans. And while both of those teams have a lot of talent, they also have two very injured quarterbacks.
Yes.
They're going to get to play Brett Hundley instead of Aaron Rodgers and Tom Savage, probably, instead of Deshaun Watson, who are both out for the year with bad injuries, unfortunately. Rodgers may come back. That's to be decided later in the playoff time if the Packers to make it. The Packers have lost 3 in a row without Rodgers. That's a very winnable game for Baltimore all of a sudden. After the Texans, they play the Lions, they go to Pittsburgh, they go to Cleveland, and they finish hosting the Colts and the Bengals. 6 of those 7 teams have losing records, or 500 or below.
500 or below records, exactly. And of course, the 7th game, the one that has a winning record right now, is Sunday night against the Steelers on December 10th. And obviously in those Baltimore-Pittsburgh games, really as a cliche, you throw the records out, and that's going to be my hot take for the week.
Oh, man.
Baltimore and Pittsburgh have played so many close games over the years. These teams know each other so well that the Ravens will probably be underdogs in that game, but it doesn't mean that the Steelers are going to outclass them.
I like to say anything can happen in the Ravens-Steelers game except for a 34-31 score.
Right.
It's usually 19-13 and 3 fumbles.
The ugliest game you've seen in the entire season.
The Ravens fans around here that you and I know would love to have that feather in their cap of being able to beat Pittsburgh since they lost the first meeting between the teams this season. But the truth is, it would be nice for the Ravens to claw back in the division race for your fans of Baltimore out there. But the wild card is a lot more realistic to factor in and to look at, like, right now. Do you think that we've treated the Ravens fairly? Have our takes been measured as per our mission statement?
I mean, I feel like we have. We haven't really given ourselves a whole lot of credit. Back when the Ravens were 2-0, we kind of said, well, they're not actually this good. And ever since then, they've been 2-5. So
you're right about that.
We can say that we've been too harsh on them, but they haven't won the games that they've needed to win so far this season, including this last week against the Titans, which really was a crucial game. The Titans were neck and neck with them in the wild card race.
And yet, I will briefly make the argument that the Ravens are actually better than we have pointed out. We've talked before on this show about Football Outsiders' metric defense-adjusted value over average, DVOA.
Mm-hmm.
Have team DVOA, you have unit DVOA. So the Week 10 ratings have come out since Week 9 is finished. Baltimore, surprisingly to me anyway, is 10th. They're a top 10 team in the league by this metric. It is funny to see the Los Angeles Rams number one this week because nobody expected the Rams to be as dominant on both sides of the ball as they are this year. They have the Ravens 10th, but here's why. We were just talking about their putrid offense, and the Ravens' offensive DVOA is 24th, but they are second on defense. I don't know. Is that too high? I think they've got a good defense, but is that too high?
They do have a good defense. And the biggest thing is, I mean, we talked about this before we got on the show. The Ravens have 2 shutouts this year. They have one game where they only gave up 10 points. The game they gave up the most points was against Jacksonville when they lost 44-7. But Joe Flacco was awful in that game.
Yeah.
The defense kept having short fields to try to stop the Jaguars on. And so when you think about it, their defense has really shut down just about every opponent they've had to some extent.
One last note before we move on from this team. The Ravens coming in 10th overall DVOA. The New England Patriots, by comparison, 13th. That is the Patriots. Again, that's the opposite kind of defense from the Ravens. If the Ravens have a good defense, the Patriots have an abysmal defense. And if I'm seeing this correctly, they're number 1 in offense and number 31 in defense DVOA. Sounds about right. According to Football Outsiders, people, 12 teams, including your Baltimore Ravens, are better than New England. So put that in your pipe and smoke it. I don't know what else to say. I love this kind of stuff. But we should move on to a team that will play this coming weekend, and
right,
that is Washington. Okay, I've got to reveal my biases before we go any further, and I get accused of any sort of preferential treatment. Washington played Seattle and beat Seattle this weekend. I am an undercover Seattle fan because my dad...
Your Seahawks.
My Seahawks. I will own it for a minute because my dad, who has no connection to the city of Seattle other than he thinks it's pretty, has been a Seahawks fan since the 80s. He's not a bandwagoner, and I'm not a bandwagoner. He suffered. He suffered through Dave Craig. He suffered through not drafting Bledsoe. He suffered through some bad teams and coaches to get his glory and his Seahawks Super Bowl win a few years ago. So I root for the Seahawks because I root for my dad to be happy. I want him to be happy. They lost. But one of the most astounding things, Dylan, is that Washington has never lost at Seattle since they built the new stadium, CenturyLink Field.
4-0 at CenturyLink Field.
Yeah, a place where Seattle is supposedly very dominant. The one team Seattle has not beaten since that field opened, at home anyway, is the Washington football team. I almost said it. I'm glad I watched this game on Sunday because I have mathematical proof that it was the most exciting game of the NFL weekend, Dylan.
I feel another nerd stat coming. Hit
Love
me with it.
I will. NumberFire. If you're not familiar with it, that's okay. It is a website. One of many things NumberFire has to offer in terms of advanced metrics is win probability before and during games. And then after the game, you can check out what it looked like. So I was looking at this after the game. You remember that play right at the end when Washington completed pass to Josh Dotson and got all the way down to the 1 yard line on their last chance drive?
He almost crawled into the end zone.
He nearly crawled in the end zone because Shaquille Griffin, the rookie cornerback, didn't touch him down. Still playing by college rules, as Charles Davis was saying on the broadcast. Washington's win probability before that play, when that play snapped, was 28% by their calculations. And that one play changed their win probability by 32% up to 60.17% chance to win once they found themselves on the 1 yard line with about a minute to play. And they punched in with Rob Kelly right after that. That was, according to NumberFire, the single play with the biggest shift of win probability of any of the games this weekend. No game shifted on one play more than the Washington-Seattle game shifted on this play from Cousins to Dotson. It was 38 yards downfield to the one, and like we said, Shaquille Griffin was covering him, and not only did he get beaten by Josh Dotson, who's a good receiver, and nobody really gives him credit for that, Griffin did not touch him down.
That was a hot take. Nobody gives Josh Dotson credit for being a good receiver.
Except Mike Clay. Go follow Mike Clay on Twitter at Mike Clay NFL. So sorry, Dad. This whole thing was supposed to be a shout out to my dad being a Seahawks fan and me watching the Seahawks game because it was on TV here in Maryland. But look, they lost. It's unfortunate for Dad, but he'll still listen to my podcast. He still loves me. Dylan, I've talked a lot about Washington already, but that's a big win.
It is a big
win. For the burgundy and gold.
Yeah, we've talked in this show before about the stretch that Washington is in right now, playing three straight division leaders. They had the Seahawks last week. They have the Saints in 2 weeks. And then this week coming up, it doesn't get any easier for them. They play the Minnesota Vikings, who now are 6-2. They've won four games in a row. They look like they might be the best team in the entire NFC. And not only that.
But what about the Eagles?
What about the Eagles?
You know, what about the Rams? There's a lot of good NFC teams.
There are a lot of good NFC teams.
But the Vikings clearly are the NFC North division leaders. So right. They're not even much of a wild card threat anymore because they seem to have a handle on that division.
They do.
Nonetheless, I don't mean to take away from your point. It's a very big game for Washington to have to show up in.
The biggest development in that game this week before the game is that Vikings quarterback Teddy Bridgewater, who has been out since training camp before last season when he suffered that really tough, gruesome knee injury that he had. He is now on the active roster, just recently placed there. Their other quarterback who had been injured, Sam Bradford, went on injured reserve, so he's out most likely for the season. So Bridgewater is active this week, but Case Keenum is still going to start. So we'll see if they use Bridgewater at all, if he plays, and we'll see how that plays out, but that is going to be something that Washington fans should definitely be watching for because it adds a new dimension to this Vikings team. And obviously, before he got injured last season, Bridgewater was on his way to becoming one of the best young quarterbacks in the NFL.
He had a lot of potential. He still does have a lot of potential. He is only 24 years old. He last played a regular season game in the end of 2015.
Exactly.
And here we are in November of 2017, and this gruesome injury might finally be in the rearview mirror for Bridgewater. That is something the Washington fans will need to keep an eye on. Something else is the Vikings defense. Not that Seattle's wasn't tough, but the Vikings might be the toughest defense they come across.
Right, especially the way the matchup works this week, because the Vikings, one of their strong suits this season has been stopping running backs making catches out of the backfield. That obviously is a huge strength for Washington. They rely on those screens and short passes. Chris Thompson, as we've talked about before on this show, is the leader in yards after catch in the entire NFL. He has 453 yards receiving officially, and by ESPN's metrics, he has 456 yards after the catch, which is just incredible. He has more yards after catch than he has total yards, meaning he's catching the ball often out of the backfield behind the line of scrimmage.
Yeah.
And Minnesota is one of the best teams in all of football at stopping exactly that. Now, Thompson is eighth in the league with 35 catches. For running backs, he's eighth in the league with 35 catches. Now, in front of him is Duke Johnson with 36 catches. Duke Johnson played the Vikings earlier this season when they met the Browns. Duke Johnson had four catches for 10 yards in that game. So that's something that the Vikings are definitely going to gear up to stop Thompson because they know those screens are a huge part of the Washington offense, and it'll be interesting to see whether Washington changes their game plan at all, knowing that Minnesota is very adept at stopping those plays.
Not to mention that offensive line is still banged up, yeah, and makeshift group of backups.
Yeah. Makeshift is a good word for it.
All that means is Kirk Cousins is going to have a lot on his shoulders to do what he just did against Seattle and pull it out. Even though Cousins didn't throw a touchdown, it was very much his heroics toward the end there that let Washington win that game in Seattle. So this has been a great NFL segment, so let's end it on some players to watch. We don't have any Ravens to do, so let's move to Washington right away. And in our Twitter poll this week, winning by a narrow margin is inside linebacker Zach Brown, somebody who doesn't get a lot of credit. Zach Brown leads the league in tackles with 86, 10 more actually than C.J. Mosley of Baltimore, who's second and who was one of our players to watch last week, Dylan.
Yeah, we're on a roll.
Yes. Look, take it from the guy who had to watch the New York Jets cut David Harris over the offseason, the most underrated player they had this decade. These run-stopping middle linebackers are underrated. They're valuable players. Brown actually had 149 tackles for Buffalo last year. And in free agency, he was only rewarded with a one-year, $2.3 million contract by Washington. That's how they valued him. So Brown is now on pace, actually, for 172 tackles this year. He had 11 against Seattle last week, but his season high is actually 13, and he's had double-digit tackles in 6 out of 8 games so far. Also, according to Pro Football Focus, Brown had a grade last year of 84.1. This year, it's slightly down thus far to 81.8, but that is actually good for the 15th best linebacker in the league. Not just inside linebacker, but all linebackers overall. Washington, you know, they're pretty mediocre in run defense and run of the mill. They're 16th in yards per game allowed, but I will point out that they have only allowed 3 runs of 20 or more yards and 0 runs of longer than 40 yards this season, meaning that that second layer of defense, you know, isn't letting runners get by them. And that's a testament of what Brown can do for you.
good one, Adam.
All right, I nailed it. We're going to get out of the segment on that. But when we come back, we're not done with this team yet, and our colleague Daniel Chafkin is going to join us. We're going to talk to him about an article he wrote recently for CNSMaryland.org about the Gruden coaching tree when we come back.
Hello and welcome back to War on Hot Takes. We are now joined in studio by our CNS colleague, Daniel Chafkin. Daniel, thank you for being here.
I'm happy to be back here.
This is the second time that Daniel's been on with us, and this time he's here because he wrote an article that was published last week called "To Build Staff, Jay Gruden Relied on His NFL Coaching Social Network." That is the name of the article, and you can find it now on CNSMaryland.org. Go check it out, along with, as we've said, all the other incredible journalism that's on there. Now, Daniel, why did you decide to write an article about Jay Gruden's coaching tree?
You know, I've kind of always been fascinated by coaching trees and coaching search, and I'm always very interested in the kind of the Black Monday aspect of the NFL and kind of to see who replaces who. So I kind of had this idea of trying to find some prominent coaching trees, and since we are in the Washington area, we kind of focused on Jay Gruden and where he came from. Kind of, instead of going from tree down, we went kind of up a little bit, just to see kind of where Jay Gruden came from, whether or not he used those trees he came from to kind of fill out his staff, and where his influences relied when filling out his staff.
And what did you find when you ended up researching and doing this piece in terms of how familiarity influences who's getting hired by whom?
Well, Jay Gruden is really part of two coaching trees. He's only been a coach on three NFL teams. He was a coach in Tampa Bay under his brother John. He left, he coached in the AFL for a little bit, came back, was the offensive coordinator for Marvin Lewis's Cincinnati Bengals for a couple of years. And I found that he relies a lot more on John Gruden's coaching tree than he does on Marvin Lewis's coaching tree. I got the idea that he really used Marvin Lewis and the Bengals to get back into the NFL after spending years in the AFL. But he made his connections, he made his relationships in Tampa Bay with John, and then other coaches there, guys like Kyle Shanahan, Sean McVay, Mike Tomlin. That's where he really created his relationships, and he still uses those relationships today.
You just talked about it. John Gruden was a large part of the research that you did for this. What kind of has been the impact of John Gruden on the NFL's current coaching landscape?
Well, John's coaching tree isn't as big, as broad as some other guys, like maybe like a Bill Parcells or something like that, but there is still that influence there. Even guys, Jay Gruden was there for, I think, 7 years in Tampa Bay with him, but even guys like Kyle Shanahan was only there for 2 years, and he's now a head coach in San Francisco. So people who John really worked with and groomed, and there's a lot, if you go back to his staffs 2002, 2003, 2004, that's really where you'll find a lot of head coach and offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator materials, guys who started out young, started out as really low-level assistants, quality control, or just general assistants, and kind of built their way up, more so than John's offensive and defensive coordinators, I would say. Kind of took a little bit to get those prominent head coaches. You see that this season with the success of Jay Gruden, with the success of Sean McVay in L.A., and even in the past, you know, Mike Tomlin was there for like 4 or 5 years with John Gruden. So it is significant. It's not as big as some other head coaches and some other head coaching trees, but it is significant, and it will continue to grow as these head coaches thrive in their areas.
Now, tell us a little bit about the data you've collected and the way it's presented in this article, which, again, not only is on CNSMaryland.org, we'll also throw it up on our Twitter feed at War on Hot Takes, like we like to do. And you said this is called a social network visualization in your article, right? How does this work?
Yeah, well, I call it a web. I think it's a web's a good way to describe it. So it's really based around, as I said, two coaching trees. One's John Gruden and one's Marvin Lewis. And each of those are the first two trees you'll see, the first two webs you'll see. And what they are is I took every coach that has worked with every head coach I analyzed in this analysis. So I believe it's eight or nine in John Gruden's and 6-ish in Marvin Lewis. And I took every head coach who they've worked with, so guys like Marvin Lewis, Mike Zimmer, Jay Gruden, Hugh Jackson, every head coach that they've worked with at the NFL level since they've been in the NFL. And then I tried to find connections. Who's worked with who? A pretty easy example, I guess, Jay Gruden and Sean McVay worked together in Washington, so anyone on the 2016 Washington coaching staff has a connection with both Sean McVay and Jay Gruden. And so what you'll see is lines connecting coaches who have connections. If there's a situation where there's one coach, just one random coach, only connects with one head coach, then you'll only see one line with that coach. The more connections a general coach has, the more central they are. And the stronger the connection is, the thicker the lines. And that's the other thing is, you know, when you look at Marvin Lewis's web, you see these thick orange lines. And that's because Marvin Lewis was a head coach, started in, I think, 2003 with the Cincinnati Bengals. And he's had a lot of coaches who've been with him since 2003. So he's got very thick lines. The thinner the lines, the weaker the connection is. So that's kind of how that goes. And then in terms of the colors, kind of separated into these groups, these separate networks, where each color is a different group in terms of how strong certain coaches have with each other. So in terms of Marvin Lewis's tree, you'll see six different groups because the six head coaches don't have as strong connections. But if you go back up to the John Gruden tree, you'll see Jay Gruden and Sean McVay share a network, share the red color, because they've worked with so many coaches together. Kyle Shanahan, Raheem Morris, John Gruden, Bill Callahan. And that's just because they have so many connections with each other that that's easier to connect and keep those groups together than it is to separate them. And then as you kind of go down, take a coach and then see which head coaches they've connected with, and it's the same idea. Colors scheme's the same. Once again, the stronger the line, the thicker the line, the stronger the connection. And I took a couple head coaches to kind of see how they fit into the John Gruden coaching tree.
I will say, from already having read this article, and again, we encourage you to as well, that these social network visualizations, these webs, as Daniel called them, are incredibly intricate and they are very well done. This was a masterpiece by Daniel. So let's spin this forward a little bit. And we talked last segment about Washington playing the Vikings this week. And obviously, Mike Zimmer and Jay Gruden were both coaches under Marvin Lewis. What did you find about those guys and their connections?
Well, as I said, Jay Gruden's connection with Marvin Lewis's coaching tree isn't as strong, isn't as big as his connection with John Gruden's coaching tree, but he did work there for 3 years. Zimmer and Gruden were both the coordinators from 2011 to 2013. Zimmer had already been there a couple of years. Gruden just started in 2011. So they have all the connections with the Bengals coaches, and that's kind of what you'll see when you're comparing Mike Zimmer with Jay Gruden, is there's these Bengals connections. But Mike Zimmer's connections to Marvin Lewis are a lot stronger because he was there longer and because he kind of used the Marvin Lewis coaching tree more as a jumping off point to build his coaching staff. Jay Gruden, when building his coaching staff, relied more on his John Gruden's, as I said. So where you'll see the connections between those two is in Cincinnati. Mike Zimmer, when you go through the Marvin Lewis coaching tree, that's when Mike Zimmer, you'll see his influence. Mike Zimmer, I would say, yeah, he was with Bill Parcells for a little bit. I would say one of his biggest influences is Marvin Lewis. A lot of members of his current coaching staff have some connection to either Marvin Lewis or people who have worked for Marvin Lewis. And it's almost like a 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon thing, you know, where even if a coach doesn't have a direct connection with Marvin Lewis, you can kind of find someone who does on Mike Zimmer's coaching staff. It's a little harder to do that with Jay Gruden.
Well, Daniel, I think that's about all we had for you. Thank you very much for being in the studio with us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be back. You guys got a seat today. So.
Didn't make you stand. We're a real operation now. Thank you again, Daniel. Really appreciate it. Dylan, let's wrap it up.
That's it for War on Hot Takes this week. Thank you again for joining us. As always, check us out on Twitter at War on Hot Takes. And again, read Daniel's article and the rest of the sports journalism and all the journalism at cnsmaryland.org. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next week.